Welcome to the Daily Dive Weekend Edition. I'm Oscar Ramirez, and every week I explore the top stories making waves in the news and some that are just plain interesting. I'll connect you with the journalists and the people who know the story and bring you news without the noise so you can make an informed decision. You can catch a new episode of the Daily Dive every Monday through Friday, and it's ready when you wake up. On the Weekend Edition, I'll be bringing you some of the best stories from the week. This week, we also saw the leak of the Pandora Papers, and it's shedding light on the financial secrets of world leaders, politicians, fugitives, and con artists. These leaked records show how big power players are stashing assets in secret shell companies, offshore tax havens, and trusts, with governments doing little to stop it. For more on what's in the Pandora Papers, we'll speak to Michael Hudson, senior editor at the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, the group who led the effort in obtaining these documents.
These are documents that you know, first of all, the offshore system, it's in some cases people use it for, they're on the up and up. They're using it to do business, across borders, that kind of things. But often, too often, the offshore system is used to help people dodge taxes. It's used to launder money. It's used to cover up the movement of proceeds of financial crimes like Ponzi schemes and the looting of public funds by public officials. And so we've got almost 12 million files from 14 different offshore services providers. That's like law firms and wealth management advisors and others that basically are like the middlemen. They're the fixers who help people who want to go offshore, help them set up offshore companies, offshore trusts, and other kinds of things. And often sort of not just say, oh, you get here, it's $1,200, here's an offshore company. They actually set up sort of layers, like an offshore company is owned by a trust. And then the trust is controlled by another offshore company. And of course, all along the way, the people involved with these different entities are often not the real people who control the money or who are benefiting from this, but they're actually what are called nominee directors and nominee shareholders, who are really just front men. Their job is to basically say, okay, you can use my name, you can attach my name to that company. Right. And then when law enforcement authorities or a court order comes to me, I can honestly say, I have no idea what goes on with that company. It's just my name.
How do you go about obtaining these documents? Are they done through subpoenas and, the United States Freedom of Information request? I mean, how do you go about getting this stuff? Because obviously this stuff comes out and it makes a lot of people look really bad.
Some of that's going to have to remain a mystery. I can tell you we didn't get it through any sort of subpoena or anything like that. That we did, we worked our sources and eventually got, a series of document dumps that came to us. These are our confidential secret documents that came to us from basically 14 different right. service providers around the world, from the Caribbean to the South China Sea and just all around the world. And the other thing that happens is you just don't take these documents and you say, here, there's all these names in these documents. We actually did reporting. We spent 2 years working on this project. In addition to, we read through the documents, we consulted with experts, we used public documents to compare to the secret documents. We tracked down, really hard to trace sources around the world. We looked through court records, and we had the resources to do this because we were able to put together a team of 150 news outlets around the world, including the Washington Post, the BBC, the Guardian, Radio France, the Indian Express. And in all, we had more than 600 journalists right. in 117 countries and territories, which is the biggest journalism investigative reporting project in history.
Let's talk a little bit about some of these key findings here. So there's a lot of big leaders of countries who have been caught up in this. So we're looking at the King of Jordan, King Abdullah II. We're looking at leaders from Kenya, Ecuador, the Czech Republic, people tied to Vladimir Putin as well.
And also former Prime Minister, British Prime Minister Tony Blair. I'll tell you dive a little deeply into the King of Jordan. The King of Jordan, the documents and our reporting shows that an accountant in Switzerland worked with lawyers in the British Virgin Islands to help the king secretly purchase 14 luxury homes worth more than $106 million altogether in the U.S. and the U.K., including three side-by-side, a trio of luxury homes on the beach in Malibu, California. The advisors also helped him set up 36 shell companies from 1995 to 2017. And we see in the emails, they were really trying to keep his name on the down low. Some of the offshore advisors that were helping him simply used the code name, you know who.
I love that, you know, because we're talking about, you know, all the secrecy and the shadiness that goes into this. And even in their emails, you know, they're trying to conceal the identity there with such, you know, large sums of money and all that. Continuing on of this, right? Jordan receives a lot of financial aid from a lot of different countries and whatnot. They say, I guess, that the King of Jordan bought these properties and all this stuff with his own personal fortune. But
yeah, and his attorneys say, oh, by the way, he's not required to pay taxes under Jordanian law because he's the king. And that's understandable. But as one of our experts on sort of political authority in the Middle East said, look, despite the fact that he doesn't have to pay taxes, he has reason not to flaunt his wealth, to keep his wealth undercover, because both his citizens and the donors, the places like the U.S., foundations, et cetera, that are putting aid money into Jordan are going to be kind of upset when they hear that, oh, he's got all these luxury properties around the world.
I want to talk about the United States because this reaches many corners of the world, but the United States figures into this in a pretty prominent way because, so we're looking at offshore accounts. We're also looking at people setting up trusts as well. And the United States became a key player in that, specifically South Dakota, which is just kind of an interesting one. And, you know, some of these other states that were involved in this are Florida, Nevada was another one, Texas, that involved in this. But tell me about South Dakota specifically and how they figure into this.
You know, South Dakota is a state that is kind of in the last 5 years or so has sort of to some degree turned itself into kind of like a Cayman Islands on the Great Plains. If you live in another country and you want to cast a shadow, essentially hide some of your assets, you can get a trust in South Dakota, you know, and it will protect your money. It will generally protect your identity. And so we've seen, you know, lots and lots of foreign officials, folks with sort of sketchy backstories have been accused of wrongdoing in their home countries, you know, moving money to U.S. states like South Dakota.
How does the U.S. system, you know, allow for all of this? You always kind of envision this happening, as I mentioned, as you were mentioning earlier, you know, things like in the Bahamas are usually what we think of when we're talking about tax havens. You know, how does that migrate itself here? Like, you know, with our U.S. laws, at least.
Yeah, when somebody says offshore tax haven, they're usually going to get an image in their mind of like palm trees, right?
Yeah,
because they're thinking
exactly.
It's an island, right? Or maybe, you know, like Switzerland, like, you know, snow-capped Alps or something. But, you know, the United States, individual states have been able to give the rest of the offshore havens in the world a run for their money. And right now the laws in the U.S. on the federal level, they're trying to tighten up and make it harder for the states to essentially hide the owners of offshore companies, of companies created in Nevada or Delaware. But still, there are a lot of loopholes, and it's pretty easy for someone overseas to sort of hide their money, hide their assets here in the United States. And that's interesting because the United States has kind of gone, you know, been sort of styled itself as the global policeman of the offshore world. It's gone after banks in Switzerland for, you know, hiding American assets from the IRS. It's gone after, you know, the British Virgin Islands and other sort of these sort of offshore paradises for their role in the offshore system. Meanwhile, there are a lot of states that are drawing in a lot of money for the U.S. and just have become cogs in this sort of global system.
Right. Yeah. The states with the most trust in the Pandora Papers and all of this is South Dakota, Florida, Delaware, Texas, and Nevada. So I'm sure there's going to be a lot made of that as more people start getting to this reporting. Michael Hudson, senior editor at the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Finally, for this week, a little bit more on the fallout from the Pandora Papers. Part of a global hunt into looking for looted treasure has led to the offshore trust of art dealer Douglas Latchford. Latchford has trafficked and profited from Cambodian artifacts he obtained over the years. He was indicted in 2019, but died shortly thereafter. And the big question came out, what happened to all the money and looted treasures? For more on how the Pandora Papers shed some light on where these relics might be, we'll speak to Peter Horisky, reporter at the Washington Post.
Douglas Latchford was an Englishman who moved to Thailand. We're not exactly sure when, but he was a fairly young man there and was smitten by Khmer art, the artifacts from the Khmer Empire. You know, that's Angkor Wat. It's the big tourist area there. And he was, you know, like I said, smitten by this beautiful art that was created between the 9th and 15th century, and started his own collection. What we learn later is that part of his collection was based on just looting sites all over Cambodia, not himself, but he was in touch with looters. He would get the objects, often quite cheap, and then they would end up in the hands of being sold to collectors and, you know, some of the most prestigious museums around the world.
He was indicted by the U.S. in 2019, but the other kind of unfortunate thing is he passed away since then. So it's this big old question of what happened to all the money associated with this, all the looted treasure. And this is where the Pandora Papers play a part. You know, we're starting to get a few of those answers, possibly.
You know, when they indicted him in 2019, he was into his late 80s. By that time, he'd had a pretty full and long career. And as part of the indictment, the prosecutor said, we want the return of any criminal proceeds and we want the return of any objects back to Cambodia. But when he died shortly after the indictment, it left open this question. So where is the money? Where is the loot? And that's what the Pandora Papers helps us answer, at least to a certain extent, is he had an offshore trust, Skanda Trust, that was set up in the island of Jersey and run by another company that was registered in the British Virgin Islands. And the Skanda Trust had a lot of relics. It also controlled hedge funds and some private bank accounts. And so he had an awful lot of money and objects in that Skanda Trust. But as I pointed out, there's actually quite a few of his objects that may have been smuggled that are in museums around the world. So it's sort of like the Cambodians are currently on a treasure hunt in a way. They're trying to get all that stuff back.
And that's why the Pandora Papers are so important in this, because it kind of, you know, linking the paper trails, I guess, right? Because you set up one trust, transfer things to another trust, set up a shell company to run those trusts. You know, it's just, you know, layers upon layers, and it gets pretty murky on all of that. And, you know, for the Cambodians themselves, when they talk about these artifacts, the Cambodian Minister of Culture and Fine Arts, he says, you know, these objects are not just decorations. They have spirits and are considered lives. You know, it's important to them, to their history. And going back to these museums, there's museums all over the world that are attached to Latchford. They hold pieces that we don't know, possibly were obtained legally, possibly were looted from, you know, these temples. But we're talking about the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, Denver Art Museum, the British Museum in London, museums in Australia. For their part, how do they respond to these types of things?
Basically, no comment was their initial take with us, or that no comment, and we're working on it. But this has been their position for years, that we're looking into these objects and we're doing due diligence, and if we see a problem, we'll return them. But there's at least a couple of cases that we point out in the story where in the museum there's a piece that matches the description of a piece that's named in the indictment as looted, or described in the indictment as looted, that stands in the museum. And, you know, there's critics who say they really need to take a deeper look at their own collections and see whether or not the story that Latchford would tell about each one of these items is actually correct. For, you know, he would make up stories. Say, oh, I got this one from this guy. Or, in fact, he invented, we're not sure if this guy was, and that's mentioned in the indictment. But anyway, he kept saying, oh yeah, I got it from this guy, Ian Donaldson. And he continued to say this after 2001, when Donaldson had died. So clearly anything that came from Donaldson after 2001 is a bit sketchy.
You know, experts say that if you have any pieces in your museum that are tied to Latchford, you should really make the extra effort to see where it's come from, where it came from, and past ownership and all that, just to see if they're legit. You talked about how, you know, Latchford himself was really into these relics and, you know, moved into the area. People that knew him said it was a genuine obsession with him. He wrote books about his adventures, some real Indiana Jones type stuff of, adventures that he would go with other people and go to these sites and look for these things. Tell me a little bit about that. As I mentioned, he wrote books. He mentioned people almost trying to fool people in a sense to say, hey, these things were obtained legitimately.
I think he was something genuine about his enthusiasm. He would take helicopters into these remote areas of Cambodia where there were these temples that were somewhat overgrown and would run around looking for artifacts. It wasn't easy work, or it's not an easy tourist trip either. There were times when, you'd see signs for landmines because the country was still dealing with, the civil wars that they'd had there for so long. It was a risky business, but he was up to the challenge because he wanted to get in there and get that art.
Yeah, the ransacking of a lot of these temples was really big in the 70s. And for Latchford, they say that he was a big part of this illicit trade that was happening all the way from the 70s up until 2010. One of the big moments where things changed for him was in 2011. He was about 80 years old at that time. There was a French archaeologist who discovered something. There was clear evidence that one of the pieces that he was either had donated or sold to that was going to be put in a museum, there was clear evidence that it had been looted. And one of those key things is you look at the statues and you look at the bottoms, you look at the feet, and you can see chisel marks. You can see that they were cut. And, that was one of the clear things that this French archaeologist noticed. And then that's kind of what triggered a big investigation to Latchford.
Right. That was kind of the beginning of the end. That happened in 2011. He wasn't indicted for another 8 years, but that was the event that sort of set in motion what would become his indictment. Basically, a lot of these statues have no feet when you see them in the museum. And the reason is that they were hacked off at the ankles because one of the difficulties when you're looting is transportation, and the pedestals are quite heavy, difficult to move. So if you can hack them off at the ankles and move the statue that way, that's what they often did. So what French archaeologists noticed is that Sotheby's had put up this statue called the Duryodhana, and he looked at that, and then he started to do some measurements based on the photography, and he goes, I know where the feet to that statue are. They're in this place that had been looted in the 70s. I think it was the 70s. So this piece had been, looted, at least in the recent decades. And after that happened, Sotheby's had to stop the sale, and the piece was returned, and U.S. investigators got in there. And then there were follow-up indictments of another gallery, and then finally in 2019 was Latchford's indictment.
And again, this is where the Pandora Papers come into play. After that initial one that happened, and investigators are starting to look into him, a lot of these relics started moving into these offshore trusts that he and his family were organizing. I guess a lot of them, his daughter was named as a beneficiary. So, all of that paper trail started going. And now, I guess for her part, his daughter, Julia, is trying to return some of those artifacts, but there's still very little is known as to what is in those trusts.
And that's frustrating for the Cambodian officials who are trying to relocate all those artifacts and bring them back to Cambodia, because in fact they didn't know of the existence of one of the trusts. There's two trusts. One's called Skanda and one's called Siva. And everybody knew that there was a Skanda trust, but I don't think anyone had the paperwork that showed that this was actually a legal entity that Latchford had created in Jersey. And I don't know that anyone had heard of the other Siva trust, which also held his collection. And so this will help them presumably track down and make the case for returning some of the objects that had been held by those trusts.
Peter Horinsky, reporter at the Washington Post, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
That's it for this weekend. Be sure to check out the Daily Dive every Monday through Friday. Join us on social media at Daily Dive Pod on Twitter and Daily Dive Podcast on Facebook. Leave us a comment, give us a rating, and tell us the stories that you're interested in. Follow the Daily Dive on iHeartRadio or subscribe wherever you get your podcast. This episode of the Daily Dive has been engineered by Tony Sorrentino. I'm Oscar Ramirez in Los Angeles, and this was your Daily Dive Weekend Edition.